Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Community. I'm Chris Daniel, your hostess with the mostest.
And hello from me, Alexis. Currently experiencing the identity crisis when you're not muscly enough to be a jock, but you're also too smooth to be a bear.
On this episode, we'll continue exploring the meaning of intersectionality and how overlapping identities affect people's lives.
The shared experience that we all carry is that we're not heterosexual or cisgendered. Some in our family are even both. But that's not all any of us is. Our sexuality and our gender is one part of our makeup and identity, and we all have different characteristics, features, and backgrounds that will overlap with these to create differing experiences. The LGBTQ spectrum is pretty unique in the way that it cuts across race, religion, class, education. Anybody could be LGBTQ. And so that means we need to understand how some of the other identities that people carry can intersect with their experiences and life within our Rainbow Village.
And so that's where we find ourselves today, speaking to Phil Samba, an advocate for HIV and sexual health, who talks about these issues and his experiences navigating queer culture as a black man, followed by Callum Zizek, a young scriptwriter and wheelchair user who has to physically navigate our world in a very different way and deal with other stereotypes and assumptions. We kick off the conversation with Phil, asking him if he thought representation matters.
Massively, especially within the LGBTQ community. It's been a little bit whitewashed in the sense of in a lot of black communities, we can consider like being gay a white thing, particularly like, let's say, African Caribbean communities, especially with people in their like 40s and 50s, they will see, consider, let's say, people like us kind of deciding to do this because we've seen it happen by white people, or we're mimicking their behavior and stuff like that. And I think we have similar views with mental health as well. It's a cultural thing. We're not really brought up with stuff. We don't talk about mental health, and we don't talk about, you know, sexuality outside of the heteronormative society. But things are starting to change, I feel. Even in my own family, like when I came up, my mom wasn't comfortable with it, but it became more about what would people think of me more than my happiness. What people thought of her were more important than me being comfortable with myself or me expressing myself.
Sometimes when I hear other black LGBTQ people's experiences, I think that we must have all grown up in the same house. When I came out for the first time at 18 years old, I was told that it wasn't normal for a Jamaican person to be a lesbian, and I must have learnt it somewhere. I asked Phil how his relationship with his mum has evolved.
That's a tricky question. It's weird because I feel like because of the work that I'm doing, it's like now she wouldn't have a problem with it because now it's becoming about status. So what she was worried about initially, which was what are people going to think because you're gay? Now it's like I'm gay, I'm black, I'm successful. So it's like, yes. It's a weird one because it's very public and because I'm very successful, it's like it becomes this whole situation. It's really interesting. Particularly in West African culture, you've been brought up to represent your family. And it's like, it's a lot of pressure and you don't actually realize how much pressure it is because this is like your life. This is your culture. This is what how you've been brought up. But then when you get to like an adult and then you look back on things and you're like, that was actually quite tough. It's quite difficult to uphold that reputation all the time. And it's like, you couldn't be the perfect child at all times. It just was impossible. My mom took that whole culture thing about what people think of us to the next level. And I think I had it enforced on me a lot harder than most people. But like now I don't care. Like I'm not trying to pretend to be something I'm not.
What Phil touches on here, that his mum has started to accept his sexuality because he's built himself a successful career, happens to many of us. How many of us in the LGBTQ spectrum have been driven to work harder out of necessity to either survive, escape where we're from, or to win approval from our parents?
The thing is, I really care about the health of us as in black people, us as in LGBT black people. And I think there's a lot of issues. The system is kind of stuck in a lot of ways. For example, if I go into, I keep mentioning mental health, but there's a lot of stuff that does stuff for LGBT mental health, and there's a lot of stuff for black mental health, but there's not a bridge being crossed between the two of them.
So obviously you mentioned there's no intersection with black mental health and LGBTQ mental health. So like if LGBTQ black people go to an LGBTQ mental health organization, do you feel like they're not getting the help that they need?
I think most of the time, no. There's actually statistics prove that basically we don't have the same results. personally, I'm very lucky in the fact of I see a therapist, but he's black and he's gay. But I was just very, very lucky. I was extremely lucky. I don't think that happens very often.
LGBTQ people experience mental health challenges like everyone else in society. But research has shown that there are increased levels of mental health issues within our community. Let's take a look at some of these stats. 1 in 7, 13%, gay and bisexual men are currently experiencing moderate to severe levels of mixed depression and anxiety, compared to 7% of men in general. That's almost double. A further 9% of gay and bisexual men are experiencing moderate to severe levels of depression with mild or no anxiety, compared to 2% of men in general. In the last year, 3/4, 74% of lesbian and bisexual women say they felt anxious or nervous. This increases to 78% of bisexual women and 81% of black and minority ethnic lesbian and bisexual women. These figures are taken from the Stonewall Mental Health Briefing. We continue the conversation by touching on how HIV affects different demographics.
There's certain demographics that are disproportionately affected by it. It's not just all people of colour. There's trans men and women that it affects. There's sex workers. And oddly enough, straight African men rates are going up. And in men who have sex with men, but maybe don't identify as being straight. South Asian men who are not on apps, they're not on social media, they're just cruising. And they don't test, and they test late, so they come back with like late diagnosis. So there's a lot of issues amongst, I don't know, tackling it or how to tackle it in the right way.
Do you think there's still a stigma around HIV?
Definitely. I think one of the biggest issues is that a lot of people don't know about the treatment that's available. I feel like to some extent, HIV has kind of been quietened down because it's not killing people at the rates that it used to. It doesn't mean it's not still killing people. There's still 30% of people around the world that have HIV have no idea they have it. And they don't know what medicine is available to them. There's people that are not testing regularly enough or not at all. Like I met someone that was living with HIV for 5 years before he knew. Can live up to like 10 years without having any sort of illness or any sort of symptoms. So I feel like all this information needs to be out there. It's a little bit about education, but I feel like the government needs to be more, particularly in this country. Like when you think about PrEP and how NHS England don't necessarily want to pay for us to have PrEP. And then you also think about all the cuts to the sexual health sector and all of the organisations that have lost money.
In June 2018, the BBC investigated into the threats that NHS cuts face to sexual health. It found that out of 151 local authorities in the country, almost half plan to cut funding for sexual health. Services across the country are stretched. Specialist clinics are closing, leaving no options available to local people outside of cities who face having to travel further and further to receive specialist screening, advice, and treatment. While in cities, clinics are oversubscribed and stressed. One doctor reported having to turn away almost 300 patients a week. And of course, as LGBTQ people, these cuts overly affect us and our health.
I think that more money needs to go into it, and there needs to be more campaigns, and there needs to be more people getting involved. People need to look into what's available. A lot of people have no idea about some things that, like, maybe you and I would consider really basic. PrEP's been available from 2012, but it's not in this country. It's only in this country from the trial. And a lot of people don't even know it exists, especially a lot of straight people. They have no idea what it is or how it works, or they have no idea about treatment.
What Phil mentions, PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, to use its full name, is a drug that, when correctly adhered to, has a 99% chance of preventing the user from contracting the HIV virus. It's controversial, not everyone agrees on its use or how it's used, but it is credited with seeing a dramatic drop in new HIV diagnoses. It's been available on the market since 2012, but in the UK, it's currently only readily available in Scotland, thanks to the Scottish NHS. After a legal challenge, NHS England agreed to run a trial period and provide the drug for 10,000 people. However, it's also been widely available to purchase online over the internet for many years. But all is not as good as it seems. The reality is that the drop in diagnosis has come amongst educated, white, middle-class gay men who have access, either through knowledge of the PrEP trial or through private funds to buy the drug. And while if you are white and under 25, or you are a queer person of colour or a man who has sex with men but doesn't identify as gay, diagnosis rates are high and still increasing.
I think it's the way that those demographics are targeted. For example, let's say people that are out, they're probably well informed about what is available to them. But then say a gay man of colour that lived in Hackney that let's say he only used like an app like Grindr to speak to people, he wouldn't know what information is available unless he comes across someone that's like, oh, did you know about this and this and this? But it's unlikely those kinds of conversations are happening within like apps. That tends to be a lot like one of the ways in which a lot of men first discover themselves or first meet people or first start having sex or relationships. So I feel like things like Grindr need to implement some more stuff as well. You can't quote me on this, but I think it was WHO that said that announced it to be usable from 2012, and America got it straight away. There are issues there with how expensive it is and getting it on through insurance and stuff like that. But it's always been there, whereas it's only been from 2016 that you could purchase it in this country. So I just feel like we're behind in that sort of sense. But in terms of, let's see, those other communities, I just feel like it's a very new thing. I think what we tend to do is we tend to sit back and watch and see how things go. And now that things are starting to, I guess, progress, now people are a lot more involved. I think the other thing is, through my research, I've learned that one issue with black men in particular not taking PrEP is that they don't know a lot of other black men that are on it. So that's why I try to be as visible as I can. And that's why I'm always tweeting about it and talking about it and I'm writing about it. Because I think if they can see that someone else is on it, then that might make it easier. When I did the Me, Him, Us campaign, someone said to me, they said they wanted to get PrEP, but they were really embarrassed. And then they said they saw the campaign and then that motivated them to go to the clinic.
The Me, Him, Us reference you just heard mentioned was a campaign by GMFA, the Gay Men's Health Project, to increase sexual health screening amongst gay and bisexual men from Black, Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds.
It might go back to people viewing being gay as a white thing. And like, I don't know, there's also stigma around sexual health testing. I think a lot of people, they're quite misinformed of the people that have never been, they're quite misinformed about what it actually consists of. And there is a bit of embarrassment around it. Like even for me, actually, there was a few months back, the last time I got tested, I'm on the trial and I get PrEP and everything. And I tweeted a picture of the PrEP and I was like, you should get tested every 3 months, blah, blah, blah. I did all this information. And immediately after I tweeted it, I was like, oh my God, I just tweeted about my sexual health. And then I was like, wait, it's not that deep. So even for me, we need to kind of normalize testing. I think that's what it is. And testing is going up. So there's some benefits there.
I completely echo Phil's sentiments here. There is still a stigma attached to getting tested when really it should be viewed as just an ordinary thing for any responsible adult to do. If you're old enough to have sex, you should be old enough to get tested. Just as Phil tweets about his tests, every time I get my quarterly STI check, I Instagram about it. By speaking about these things, by not being embarrassed about them, encouraging others to do so, we can all start to break the taboo and stigma which still lurks and have happier, healthier sex lives. And while we're on the subject, listeners, when was the last time you got tested? If it was more than 3 months ago, you, my friend, are overdue a checkup.
One thing that I've seen consistently on my timeline is gay men of colour speaking about their experiences when using dating apps. So I asked Phil how apps have affected his dating life.
I get annoyed. I get really annoyed with them. I get annoyed with the conversations that I have. I get annoyed with the people. I get annoyed with the urgency of it all. It gets irritating. The last two times I've had it, I've downloaded it because I was drunk. And then it's been because like I've gotten a free trial and I've just been on it for a week. But I tend to waste a lot of time on them. A lot of the conversations are quite urgent and it's like, let's have sex right this second. And like, I prefer to have a connection with sex. So I just find it really weird that we have to meet right now. It's like, can we go for a drink or something? Like it could be after the drink, but like, why does it have to be right this very second? And that urgency I can't deal with. And then sometimes like if I also turn down a non-black guy, then I get met with racism. So it's like I am already fetishized before at the beginning by, you know, so there's that whole big black cock thing because I'm black and because I'm 6'5 and whatever. And then as soon as I say I'm not interested or I can see I'm like there's sexual racism happening, then it becomes you nigger this, you nigger that, you black cunt, I don't want you anywhere. And it's just like, it's really interesting how that shift changes.
Recently, Grindr launched an initiative called Kinda on Grindr to try and combat some of the racist, femme-shaming and body phobia that is rife on their platform.
It's long overdue and it's a step in the right direction. But I think a lot more needs to be done. Because what made me laugh is when I saw the Kinda Grinda thing come up, someone said, and they tweeted this, that basically, okay, so you want to stop racism in your app, but you can put in that you want to search for like only black men. And it's just like, it just makes sense. It's like, you need to remove that feature if that's what you want. So it's just a bit ridiculous in that sense.
Brilliantly, women are now sharing that when they're on other dating apps, they might get a message from a man and kind of like deny them. Immediately they get a response back going, you be what this, you that. I wasn't interested in you anyway. You're fat, you're ugly. You think you're better than me. Gay white men also experience that sort of thing, kind of saying suddenly they're arrogant or they're up from south or they're not what they think they are. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's different? And if so, why is it different to the sorts of stuff that you receive?
Because white guys' race is never brought into this situation, like at all. Like they may become, it becomes more about their personality or like maybe their narcissism or whatever. It becomes about who they are. It doesn't become about their skin tone or the color of their skin. And a lot of the time it's racism before the conversation. It's racism after the conversation. So it's like, it's just that. And it's kind of, it's just really unnecessary in my eyes. And I feel like they don't know what effects that can have on them, particularly as a gay black man. You tend to go through a lot of shit in your life, generally. As a black man, you do. So to come out and to be comfortable with yourself and then to go into this scene and then get met with more racism, even though that we're all the same, but we've had similar experiences. So you'd think it'd be more accepting or more comfortable, but it's like we're basically a minority within a minority.
It's inarguable that racism happens in everyday life, off apps, and in the wider heterosexual society. So how does this transfer into the LGBTQ population?
Definitely, but I think it's more institutionalized. I don't think it's so deliberate, but you can feel out of place going to like a certain club and not feeling like there's other people around you. But I don't think that is, it's not like enforced or deliberately forced. I think a lot of people they're not aware, or like there'll be a lot of white guys in the club that won't think of that. So they won't think that other people might feel uncomfortable or might feel like othered or might feel like they don't belong because they're not experiencing that.
What did you think of our chat with Phil?
I think it's really important, particularly his points about sexual racism, because I don't think that's addressed enough by white people. Sexual racism is more than just abhorrently using the N-word or attacking someone who's rejected you because of their race. It comes in much more insidious forms. One way is the fetishization of black men as sexual objects, the big black cock trope that Phil mentioned. And why is this a problem? Because it dehumanizes people. It reduces them to a singular appendage. And actually, if we go way, way back, has its roots in the slave trade and how the value of a male slave was appraised. At slave markets, those poor souls on sale were naked, and male slaves were considered to be more animal-like if they had large penises, and were therefore considered to be better workers and thereby better purchases. That's racist. Now, I'm not criticizing anyone for being a size queen. Big one can be great fun. Get your rocks how you like. But it's the language that we use which is key. If you reduce a black man just to a stereotype and see them just as an appendage rather than as your equal, you're falling into sexual racism. Another way that sexual racism is pushed by white gays is through the argument of quote-unquote preference. To those people who put no blacks, no Asians, etc. on their profile and claim, it's not racist, it's just a preference. Yeah, that's actually pretty racist, dude. What you're doing is discounting a huge percentage of the world's population just on the basis that they aren't white. I have a preference for people with bright eyes, cute smiles, and perky butts. That's a preference. But refusing someone based on their ethnicity, that's racism. Simple.
At the beginning of our conversation with Phil, it felt like I was looking into a mirror because I could relate to so many things that he was saying. One major thing that I took away from the conversation is that queer women are not discussing sexual health enough. And even when I was doing my Googles and trying to find specific information about queer women's sexual health, I couldn't find anything. Sexual health is something that affects everyone, and we should all be having more open and honest conversations about it. Next, you'll hear Lex's conversation with Callum, a brilliant and witty young man who also happens to use an assisted wheelchair. He starts off by talking about how he realised he was gay.
from my own experience, it's not a point at which you suddenly wake up and you're like, oh my God, I'm gay. But it's more of a slow realization and a gradual realization as you watch your peers at school enter into those kind of teenage fun relationships, and then you begin to question why you're not as excited about potentially being in those relationships, which are typically heterosexual. And then you begin to question why you're not interested in heterosexual porn whilst all of your male friends around you are kind of talking about it and discussing it. And then you kind of come to start questioning, like, why don't I feel like this? And why do I find heterosexual porn? Why does it make me uncomfortable? And those kind of questions. And then I guess you just sort of learn, you begin to sort of see men around you and find them attractive and become sexually attracted towards them. And then that's kind of the realization that then you understand that there is a label that's assigned to this, and that is being gay. That probably sounds like a really oversimplified explanation, but obviously there's the internal turmoil that comes with that, and understanding what that means and the implications for your life moving forward and the need to come out and things like that. But yeah, I would say it's a gradual process that probably started when I was about 14 and then culminated to me coming out at probably about age 18. So growing up, my friends around me were predominantly straight. I mean, I had no openly gay friends or anyone really that I knew that was gay that I could sort of seek advice or solace from. And I'm not sure how that's kind of shaped who I am now, or my kind of my idea of wanting or needing a kind of community. But now I have much more of an awareness, having attended events like Pride in the last few years, and kind of understanding that the LGBT community is very much like a family. And I feel like in those formative years when I was much younger, I didn't have that kind of community. So accessing those community spaces didn't really happen until I came out. And then I guess sort of it began when I started dating someone, and then I found sort of the courage, because they were much more confident and overt, that they kind of led me through that and kind of introduced me. And I think having someone to do that for you makes it so much easier, because you kind of get over that fear of like, I don't know what any of this is or what any of this means, and I don't know how I should act or how I should be, or if there is a prescribed way of being. And to just have someone who just kind of just says like, fuck that, like, here, I'll just lead you by the hand, like, let's have a fun like gay time, was really exciting. And I had the benefit of, after I came out, of being in Australia post my coming out and being very much away from friends and family and from those formative years, and just being completely able to kind of reinvent myself almost with the help of someone else, my first sort of gay ally, I found that much easier to do and was able to form my own kind of community around me.
I then asked about the challenges that Callum faced on the dating scene.
So initially, dating for me always presents the challenge, and especially sort of dating in the modern age, as it were, with things like app-based dating, and have been helpful, as I'm sure many gay people will agree, in that you don't need to ask someone whether they're gay. That question has already been answered, and it's kind of a mutual assumption between you. And I think that's a huge liberation for the gay community, and not needing to kind of ask that question initially, or have the apprehension behind that question, like, oh, is this person gay? Is this person straight? I don't know. I'm too scared to ask. So I think that's great for one. But then being disabled and also visibly disabled is difficult. And I do find that is a particularly interesting route to navigate. And as of the moment, I don't have any pictures or any kind of explanation or anything to do with my disability on my profile. And I guess that comes from a fear of not wanting to be judged too soon, or to be the victim of people's prejudices, which is super ironic because that's essentially what those kind of apps are based around. But I actually have a disclaimer. So once having either matched or started talking to someone, and if it's going well and we want to meet up or whatever, then have a disclaimer that is like, hey, just full disclosure, I'm a man who wheelchair user, all of these things, I'm able to walk, like, I'm otherwise entirely, and I hate that I write this, but otherwise entirely normal, in inverted commas. And the response, I would thankfully say, like 80% of the time is fine. Like, people are generally quite understanding, always have questions, which is totally fine. I feel like if people are inquisitive, they should ask those questions rather than make assumptions or assume that. Yeah, just don't make those assumptions, essentially. But it does kind of worry me that I need to make that disclosure in the first place, because, well, it's both useful, because if they react badly and then don't want to take any further, then great, fine. Like, that's probably a good indicator that they're a terrible person and I wouldn't want to socialize with them anyway. And if they react well, then I don't know what happens in people's heads beyond that point, but you can only just kind of hope that they mean what they say and that they're being genuine when they say that they don't mind. And largely, never really encountered any huge problems, just generally people being like, oh, sorry, that's, I can't deal with that, or I'm not sure how to deal with that, and then just kind of disengaging. I mean, it hurt the first time it happened, and then after that you're just like, psh, like, you're probably a waste of space anyway, so I'm gonna let you slide. Yeah, so that's kind of initially dating, otherwise all fine and fun. And the scene and things like that is probably a slightly different story. I first sort of was exposed to it, as I said earlier, when I was in Sydney and had a partner who kind of was able to introduce me to that. And I found the whole experience, and I still find the whole experience, largely very uncomfortable. And I think that is born from my disability and this feeling that I am far more exposed and far more alien, I would say, within the gay community. And so I'm subject to feeling far more visible within the scene, and that people aren't staring because it's an attraction or an interest, but rather that I was an object of curiosity and something that was other, that wasn't expected to be in that environment. And I really felt shunned and not part of that community because of that reason, to the point where the person that I was with actually then began commenting on it and being like, this is making me feel uncomfortable because people are being so reactive to you. Not that they are also grouping him into that because he's with me, but that it's so focused on me that started sort of coming back on him, and he was like, I'm really aware of this and this is making me feel awful, like, I'm sorry for you. And I guess you develop a quite thick skin to it and become quite robust to it. And it happens anywhere. I'm not saying that this is exclusively in the gay scene. Like, people do that in the street. You do get looks and people staring at you. Generally, when they then interact with you, it's out of a place of sympathy, or they overly compensate and end up being patronising or things like that. And that's what happens, I would say, in a standard bike club, is that you can get free drinks because people were like really congratulative towards you that you're out and you're in a club, and they're like, oh, amazing, man, it's so good to see you out. And you're like, okay, like, am I not supposed to go clubbing or like enjoy myself? And I'm great that I'm a source of inspiration to you. Great, like, I'll have those vodka and cokes, thank you. Like, I'm having a great night. And that's the difference, is that sort of in a standard club, it's that, yes, there's that patronizing element to it, but I guess because of the expectation sometimes of being in a gay club or in a gay space, is that generally you are after something from that interaction. And I think that's where that kind of feeling of discomfort comes from, in that I feel like I don't adhere to that kind of classic ideal of gay male beauty, which is the kind of athletic, fit, attractive, stereotypical male, because of my disability. And it's just been something that's really sort of put me off it in general and made me feel like I can't engage with the community in a way that I would otherwise like to, and in a way that I feel other gay men do. So that if I do date or meet other gay men that have a connection with the scene and with things like that, I feel like I'm not able to connect with them in the same way because I don't have the same experiences because I've been so discouraged by it in the past.
A frustrating issue that many differently abled people face is the random intrusive questions asked by strangers, or overzealous apparent acts of help. I asked Callum about some of these experiences and what he wished people would stop doing.
I'll tell you the most extreme example of that, which is actually nothing to do with the scene, or, I mean, I don't know if this guy was gay, but I used to work at a technology store and had a customer outright ask me after chatting to them for maybe 20 minutes, so, can you have sex? I'm not sure if, I think this may just be me superimposing the answer that I would have liked to have said, but I wish I'd said, why are you asking? And sort of just put him off, because I just felt like that was a completely inappropriate question to ask anyone. That's kind of really stuck with me, because I just couldn't believe the overtness of his question. And he seemed to be an otherwise fairly sort of switched on guy, and we were having quite an amicable conversation. So I don't know if that was because of that he felt he was able to ask that question. But yeah, that's probably the most overt. And then otherwise, people just offering to push you around, or just not even offering to push you. Occasionally, I've been trying to cross a bridge in London and someone's just started doing it and been like, oh, you look like you needed a bit of help. And I was like, did I? Because I'm perfectly capable. If you reverse that, like, I'm sure there are some people who would be like, why didn't you just accept the help? That's great. But if you reverse that, if you weren't moving fast enough in a queue of people walking along a pavement and someone comes up behind you and starts ushering you to move forward because it looks like you're not walking fast enough or you're struggling to walk, would you not find that incredibly invasive and rude? Yeah, I sort of just tend to turn around to those people and just try and explain I don't need the help, and maybe just ask someone in the future. They'll be able to give you an answer if you need help. So I guess my one bit of advice with that, and with pretty much any situation when you're dealing with or interacting with someone who has a disability, is just ask the question. They'll be able to tell you whether you can help, whether they would like to accept your help. And that's just the best way to go. Just don't assume that someone is not able to do something just because of the way they look or the positions that they're in, because you don't know. And often more creative ideas come from that.
The Disability Discrimination Act of 1995, which said that businesses must begin to take steps to be more wheelchair and handicap accessible. Since 1999, businesses have been told that they must make changes to their buildings to ensure that wheelchair users can access them without difficulty. And yet, many buildings clearly lack these features and functions. Queer clubs especially, many of which you have to use stairs to access, and few of which have adapted bathrooms for people with additional needs. Callum speaks about this issue and its impact, and what he wants his fellow clubbers and the owners to consider and know.
Navigating spaces like clubs and bars is a challenge, and that's, I think, born from the fact that people with disabilities, either those wheelchair users, it could be people with visual impairments, people who use crutches, struggle to access those spaces for a myriad of reasons. Nightclubs are dark, so if you're visually impaired, that's really difficult. You're not going to be able to see as well as other people. And I'm not saying turn all the lights on in a nightclub, but there has to be an awareness that people should be able to access those spaces equally. And for me, and from my experience with a physical disability and using a wheelchair, those spaces are very inaccessible based on access. So as you said, like with steps, sometimes this works well. Occasionally a club, you will get to the front of the queue and a bouncer will be like, oh, this is fine, we've dealt with this before, all good. We have a fire entrance that you can access, and I'll radio to one of my colleagues, they'll open that for you and you can get in. You'll only be able to access this floor, but there is a bar and a toilet and everything on that floor, and also the dance floor's here. So it's, you get the large experience of the club. In those cases, great, that works really well. They've clearly thought that through. They have a contingency plan in place. In other less well-equipped nightclubs that I've been to, I have been carried into the club or walked up the stairs and then a bouncer has lifted my chair in, which is great. And that's okay, that's fine. To other clubbers, please be aware that I don't have great balance and other people will be accessing the space that maybe aren't able-bodied, so just try and keep that in mind. And then once in that club, I was then made to sign basically a handwritten declaration that essentially said, if there was a fire, I am completely responsible for my own life. And if I were to die in Zed Fire, that club wouldn't be responsible for my death. And this was literally sketched out in biro on the back of a clipboard, clearly by like a club manager who was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to sort of respond to this situation. So semi-drunk me is sort of like, I'll just sign it, because luckily enough, if there was an emergency, I would be able to walk, and I'm not just going to let myself sort of die in a fire. And also I'm with friends who would not just abandon me. But it is nice to know that the door staff would have your back, which they clearly had agreed wasn't going to be the case in this situation. So that's probably the worst. The best reactions to it are where they go above and beyond. And so they don't just help you into the club and pass those barriers of steps, but even things like ordering drinks. So I've been helped into a club by bouncers before, and they're like, if you would like to order a drink, please go to the no service area, which is slightly lower. I will let our staff know that if they see you there, they should serve you first. And they've all been trained in being aware of that. So they should all know. And I think that that's really impressive. They've clearly thought about it. It's clearly been a problem that's come up before. And so my advice to people who own those spaces, be it clubs or bars, is don't assume that everyone who is accessing your spaces is able-bodied. Anyone should want to come to your club. And the more inviting and the more easier you can make it for those people, more people will come. And surely that lifts drink sales and lifts ticket sales. And that's what you want. You just want everyone having a good time in your venue. And so to other clubbers and bar patrons, feel free to carry on buying me drinks. Like, that's fine. But don't be surprised if you see someone in a wheelchair clubbing. And I think it's really not appropriate to sit on their lap or to push them around a club or to pull them away from the people that they're dancing with just so that you can dance with them, or just to outright ask why they're in the wheelchair. I get that you're drunk. I get that your inhibitions are far looser, but just take a second to be like, would I do this or say this in real life?
People can be so unbelievably annoying. What would possess someone to sit on a wheelchair user's lap without their consent? Hearing Callum's experiences reminded me that as an able-bodied person, I need to be more considerate to those who aren't, but without being condescending. I've never had to think about whether or not a venue is accessible when I've gone out, but when AZ hosts events, we try to ensure that the venues that we use are accessible for everyone in the community. I think it's important to remember not to be self-centered and to think about how different environments affect different people. We just need to start showing a little more compassion and care towards each other.
Yeah, people can be really weird. There's something about disability that makes a lot of people either get really awkward and just pretend that they haven't noticed, get really inappropriately forward with their questions, or become super patronizing in an odd effort to be nice. The reality is a person with additional needs knows that they have those additional needs. There's no point in pretending you just haven't seen the wheelchair or the white stick. For years now, I've been volunteering with a charity that provides outdoor activities and sports experiences for young people with physical disabilities and or learning difficulties. In my time as a volunteer with the kids, and while I am by no means an expert, I have learned a few key things, such as that it's okay to ask what somebody's need is, but not why they have that need. That's personal. Don't forget your basic decency. Speak to everyone as your equal. Just because someone uses a wheelchair doesn't mean you need to simplify what you say or speak down to them. Don't make assumptions about their need, and don't help without asking. And remember, every need is different and many aren't obvious or invisible. As Christiana and Callum say, it's just about treating people with a bit more compassion and consideration. And that, my lovers, concludes this episode of Community. We hope hearing today's episode and the stories and experiences shared by both Phil and Callum helped you learn and consider other people's experiences.
For transcripts, full episodes, and our ever-expanding Get Involved section, go to our website, communitypod.com. You can get in touch with us on all socials at communitypod and by using the hashtag QMMUNITYpod. Or by emailing us at communitypod@gmail.com.
You can find us and tell all of your friends where to find us on whatever podcast app you use. just by searching Community. And please rate and leave us a review, but only nice things, otherwise the ghost of Margaret Thatcher will haunt you.